You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
Episode 74.
A podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
I'm Haiting.
I'm Matt. I have a special...
Yes. That is not one of the subjects of our podcast.
Well, it just so happens that the ScopesMonkeyChoir.com website has been having a spam attack of late.
Oh, a spam attack. Are you going to offer something from the spam?
Well, this is just a little piece of wisdom I want to share from the spam. I love visit Scopes Monkey Choir to treat hemorrhoid.
I didn't know we were good for that.
We are very good for that. So, as you may have noticed, we've been gone for a few weeks. Now, after working and playing and adventuring and traveling and such, we are back on Terra Informata. No.
Terra Hemorrhoidia.
Yeah. So we're just going to do one of our little Scopes Monkey news from the Monkey Scope episodes where we just throw a bunch of stuff at you. So, are you ready to have stuff thrown at you?
As long as it's not monkey poo.
Yes, this is where we
or yours. Don't
we clean
throw
out
poo
our cages. We clean out our cages and all the little bits of fruit that fell to the ground, we nibble up and share with
and
you.
Exactly, and offer them up to you.
Way, way back in episode 3.
3?
Way back in the beginning.
71 episodes ago.
We talked about the oldest musical instrument, which is a flute. A couple of flutes,
yes.
Actually. That were found in a cave in southwestern Germany. And they were reported originally to be about 35,000 years old.
Uh-huh. Now, these are different from the flutes that were recently on the SGU in the Who's That Noisy, right? Those are British flutes, and they're not nearly as old.
Yeah, these are different fruits. These are old flutes.
Different fruits.
I'm still on the bottom of the cage cleaning out little bits of fruit.
Rotten flutes. Bits of rotten flute.
So these are ancient flutes made of mammoth ivory.
Well, wait a second. They're made of mammoth ivory?
Yeah.
They're not the ones made of goose bones.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Weren't there
Are
ones
these
made
different
of goose
flutes?
I don't know.
No. Anyway, whatever these flutes are, the point is that there's a new analysis of them.
Okay.
They've done a new analysis and they have declared them to be even older.
Wait, they haven't discovered that mammoths have wings.
No, they have not.
Or that mammoths
and
are
geese?
You know
perfectly well that mammoths use jetpacks. So the new analysis...
I'm sorry. I'm going to be imagining a mammoth with
a
jetpack.
Baby mammoth. With would you not listen to the SGU? Can I just say the year?
Please.
42,000 years old.
What?
42,000 years old these flutes are. So this is part of a larger debate, which is when did humans enter Europe? As you all know, Neanderthals were happily living away in Europe, living their Neanderthal lives for tens of thousands of years before we came along and messed everything up for them.
Do they know that these flutes were not made by Neanderthals?
They do. There is some speculation about, where you find them.
Right.
You know, I mean, So now this is part of this larger debate, and these researchers are part of a team or a movement, bunch of people arguing that humans reached Europe about 45,000 years ago, and that these flutes are part of that.
And they spent the subsequent 3,000 years trying to figure out how to make a flute.
Right, exactly.
And
just
then 42,000
like,
years ago, they were like,
hold.
Got it!
We can't develop the semiconductor until we develop the flute. But that's it.
Because you only need a semiconductor to conduct one flute.
Ooh.
Is that a horrible segue into my bit about the British Science Museum? new orchestra. Speaking of semiconductors,
I think it was kind of brilliant myself. But please continue.
The British Science Museum, which we did not visit while we were in London,
we
opted for the Natural History Museum instead, which is a beautiful cathedral to science.
So pretty.
And please, everybody, go and look. It really is one of those buildings that makes you. It's a cathedral to science. It's those things you always see
the
church and you... Well, but you see churches and you think, religion made us do this, so there must be some good in religion. But then you see that they built a similarly fantastic, gorgeous, ambitious, and beautiful building for science, and hooray.
Yeah, and hooray.
And that's not where this exhibit is. This exhibit is next door at the British Museum of Science, the British Science Museum.
All right.
I don't know if that one is beautiful because we did not go. But I assume that it probably is since it's in the same part of town with all those grand old buildings. So this new exhibit, which is called the Universe of Sound. Oh, no. It's just called Universe of Sound.
No, the?
No, I believe it's called Universe of Sound. Mm. Because it's not the, it's a Universe of Sound.
Right, Universe of Sound.
Yes. And what it is... is it's some interactive footage of the British Philharmonic playing some of Holst's The Planets, or perhaps only one, yes, because it's the universe of sound. There's really only a solar system of sound.
Mm.
In any case, they did a full day's recording session of not only the full orchestra playing this movement, but they took... footage of smaller groups of the orchestra playing through the entire movement, and it's kind of like Google Earth for the orchestra.
Okay. All
right. So it plays, they have the sound, and you can kind of zoom in on different sections of the orchestra and hear what they are doing specifically, and kind of like tune out everybody else, and you can see them playing up close and hear their part.
So it sounds like you can sort of do your own personal mix of the orchestra and...
Yeah, visually, you know. Both visually and sonically. Yeah, so you're kind of cool. In a surround video thing that you can manipulate. And some musicians are saying that you'll be able to hear bits that no one but that section has ever heard. That things that even if you know these pieces really well, you will never have heard because the texture is just kind of within the overall texture that Holst composed. And furthermore... there is an interactive function called something like virtual conductor.
Of course.
Not semi-virtual conductor or virtual semiconductor, but... Oh, please cut that out.
Nope.
Are we still jet lagged? Is that an excuse?
That is not an excuse.
Virtual conductor, where using a combination of movement capture and all this footage... And all the amazing video technology that you can do now. Yes, you can literally conduct this virtual orchestra like a conductor would, not sort of like in a squidgy way, like it sort of like you wave your hands around and the orchestra plays faster or slower or backwards. No, it actually captures the beat pattern in your right hand and the level in space of your left hand. So a conductor, an orchestral conductor, generally in standard orchestral technique, uses their left hand to indicate volume, dynamics, and maybe feeling, and uses their right hand more as a metronome.
Right.
To
also,
the
left hand is very handy for giving the finger to some section that's really playing badly.
It sounds like you speak from experience. So anyway, you can... So if you do your beat pattern faster...
Mm-hmm.
Then the video plays faster according to the captured beat. And if you mess up the beat pattern, apparently the sections will get off from each other because they won't be able to interpret properly. The actual video won't be able to interpret properly. So, of course, all of this is from a news reporting, and it hasn't opened yet, and we don't know how it's going to work.
Right.
So please, somebody go to the British Science Museum and conduct the virtual orchestra in Universe
know how
of
it
Sound
is.
And let us know how it is.
That's
it
cool.
Sounds really cool.
That is very cool. All right, I have two small things. This first one, actually both of them, but this first one in particular is one of those ones where you are not allowed to ask me questions. No follow-up questions. Because the study is in Japanese. and only the abstract was translated, so I can't tell you anything. But toward a color-based music retrieval system, these Japanese researchers are developing the system that it analyzes lyrics and assigns colors to keywords, and then also assigns colors it analyzes sort of emotional content and also assigns colors to those. And they say their colors are picked by psychological experiment. I was very upset that I couldn't
translated by Google Translate.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. So eventually the idea is they want to have a music search system where you input colors and
what?
And you find music. I would imagine if they mean for it to actually have practical use, which one hopes maybe they mean, that it would be maybe an addendum that you have, like, it's, you know, you can include colors in your search. And I can't tell you anymore because I couldn't read it. And it just seems like...
It's not really a scientific tool. It's more like a sort of just a new version of Pandora or
yeah,
something.
No, actually, when I do look through the news and studies and such for this podcast, I almost never talk about these things. There are so many people working on music retrieval technology and algorithms and, you know, finding music on the internet and searching. I mean, it's... we all know the story. The music industry has a large teat and everyone wants to suckle it. that's the story, right? Isn't it? So there are so many people working on novel and interesting and not that interesting and unique ways to involve music. And this was just one of them. I don't usually talk about them, but I saw color and music. And that's all I'm saying. No questions? The other thing I just wanted to mention is a did you know?
I did not.
Yes. Did you know that not only have Bolivian musicians playing traditional music of the Andes, you know, not only have they toured Japan, but it has caught on in Japan in certain quarters.
Wait, I did know this,
well,
actually.
That's because you know me and I talked about it the other day.
Oh.
You're supposed to pretend. You're supposed to pretend you didn't know. Oh,
I didn't remember that it was you who told me, though. I felt like it was somebody else.
Yeah, no, in certain people in Japan have gotten totally into this Andean traditional music. And not only are there fans there, but now there are people that are starting to play it. And there actually now are professional Andes musicians in Japan who are Japanese that have gotten obsessed with the style. Isn't that cool?
Just what we need, more professional pan flute players.
Hey, man, I think the 21st century is awesome. That's all I'm saying.
No, I think I love how enthusiastic the Japanese get about things from other cultures. And of course, everyone in the world gets fascinated about something about another culture. But when the Japanese do it, they really seem to dive in and like learn it better than the culture, like they did with our classical music.
Mm, yeah. Mm.
Or bluegrass, for instance.
Or bluegrass.
There's a big bluegrass.
Huge bluegrass
in Japan.
Scene over there. Yeah, awesome. So you want to talk about landmines? No. Pianos? No.
Oh, I just wanted to mention there's this cool thing that I read about because of the 2012 Intel Science Talent Search, which is a talent search, a little contest that Intel very nicely holds and gives prizes for every year. Mm. And one of the winners this year was a 17-year-old girl. Hooray for girls making technology. Mm. And what she made was a landmine detector that was... It was reported as being inspired by her playing the piano and seeing... some banjo strings resonate in sympathy with the sound of the piano.
I'm sorry, I just remembered that Warner Brothers cartoon Daffy Duck puts the dynamite in the piano under the one note, but then Bugs Bunny never plays the right note, and he does that.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
And he never gets the right note, and Daffy Duck gets really upset and runs over and says, no, 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 it goes like this. So when you say inspired by the piano, you maybe mean inspired by Daffy Duck.
I don't think this 17-year-old was inspired by that cartoon, but that was very inspiring. Thank you, man. No, this is much more sort of like, I don't even know if she's telling the truth. It sounds sort of like an apocryphal Newton apple falling on his head kind of thing. Because what she's made has nothing, as far as I can tell, has very little to do with sympathetic vibration of strings. But the reporting is very, you know, news release-y, so I don't really know any details.
Their angle on it is...
Yeah, what she's made is basically a standard metal detector-shaped thing that goes close to the ground and... may or may not produce sound of its own, but then has very sensitive microphones and a seismic detector, an extremely sensitive seismic detector. Mm. So somehow using the frequencies of sound that comes back. It doesn't have the details in the reporting, but I wanted to just say hooray for this 17-year-old girl whose name is Marion Bechtel, who has made a landmine detector inspired by a sympathetic vibration of strings. Woohoo.
I had one other little thing I wanted to mention. This is one of these ones I'm a little skeptical of it. Tell me what you think of this. So this was a paper that just came out the other day, and it's what is it? It's a network map of music listening habits. So, and this one is freely available on archive.org. And what these researchers did is that, you know, Last.fm, Last.fm, it's a website where you can listen to music, and it's one of the many websites where you can listen to music and stream stuff and blah, blah. But Last.fm, they have geographic location and time. They keep those statistics of their listeners.
Oh.
So these researchers went back and they looked at 9 years of statistics of geographical location and timing of listening to certain songs, and they wanted to find out if they could find a sort of if they could find what's it called, not patterns but trends in whether there were certain cities that led the pack in terms of music popularity. Which is kind of an interesting question.
In terms of specific music popularity.
Exactly. Yeah. So, because now 9 years later, you know, they can look back over the last 9 years. They know what became popular and what didn't.
Tokyo. Pan flutes.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and one of the interesting things is that the network analysis tools that they used, they borrowed from ornithologists. Huh? Who had developed this software to examine the leadership networks in flocks of birds. Isn't that kind of cool? So they used these, they adapted these mathematical tools that ornithologists had made, and they looked at all this data. Now, here's some basic overview of what they say they found. In North America, Atlanta seems to lead in hip hop, meaning that Atlanta seemed to catch on to hip hop stuff that then later the rest of the nation caught on to.
Oh, flocked onto exactly. What Atlanta was listening
to. They sort of led the way. Like Atlanta's tastes in hip hop seem to be a little bit, they seem to sort of be a slightly, well, I shouldn't say predictive, because they actually make a point throughout the paper of saying this is not a predictive model yet. We're working on that, but it's not predictive. Anyway, so also Montreal leads in indie music. Now, remember, this is all of North America.
Mm. Suck so, that, Seattle.
Yeah, exactly. So then Europe, Oslo leads in general, which I don't know.
General
I don't
music?
No, exactly. Yeah, just in general, like various genres, I guess, sort of.
They just get to everything before.
And then
we
for
do.
Indie, Paris leads in Europe. For
I see. This is
so,
all
Europe. And one of the interesting things is that they sort of expected to see major cities, both in Europe and in North America, like the sort of biggest cities like New York and such, excuse me, and London and such, to be like, they're sort of popularly considered to be tastemakers. But what they did not see that. They did not see, there was actually a lot of the smaller cities that seemed to be where the real the popular music really got its foothold.
But we are talking about online listens.
Right.
Which is interesting because that might indicate that people would go to more live music in New York and maybe record stuff in New York, and then people in Atlanta who have less access to that music would listen to it online.
Right. And then you've just touched on one of the many problems I have with this. And another one to be fair, they are very careful. They don't do much extrapolation. And the other thing is that this is one website. You know, there are hundreds of music listening outlets now. I mean, as we all know, like, you can listen to music in all so many different ways. You can't even keep track of all the ways you can listen to music. So this one outlet doesn't, you can't extrapolate to the general population. You just can't. I just thought it was sort of interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating.
Because it's not like there are more people in Montreal using Last.fm than there are in New York. I mean, I don't know what the stats are, but, you know, people in New York and in Montreal listen to Last.fm. But the Montreal listeners seem to be a little ahead of the curve when it comes to the popularity.
Of indie music.
Yeah.
Not for the hip-hop.
No, that would be Atlanta. Anyway, it's sort of vaguely interesting. I can't really understand the actual math, so I can't comment on that. 2 + 2 =
But thanks to ornithologists.
And thanks to the ornithologists.
I'm seeing Daffy Duck again.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not going to do it again.
Oh.
No. No.
Are we out of time for this episode? Should we?
No, I think we have a few minutes if you wanted to talk about, for instance, ovulation.
Ovulation and sexual selection of complex music?
Oh, you really do? I just totally picked that word at random.
Ha ha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, just give us a brief overview.
Yeah, sure. All right. So I read a little paper this week called "Do Women Prefer More Complex Music Around Ovulation?" Which is an odd sentence, but basically the question is, do women prefer more complex music during the time when they're
most
ovulating,
fertile,
which is an indication of when they're most fertile?
Right.
The idea was to test the hypothesis that music might have arisen as a product of sexual selection in the same way that feather displays in birds or big horns in deer. So because no one really knows why we have music.
Right. This is part of the larger debate of why in the world did we develop music? And there are many competing theories and lots of huge arguments. No one knows. Don't let anyone tell you they know. And also, we may never know, because how do you set up a study about something that happened 200,000 years ago?
Yeah, how do you set up a study about our evolution? And this is actually kind of interesting, because it states in the introduction that there are very few empirical studies, that is, experiential studies, hands-on studies, mm-hmm. to test whether perhaps music evolved because of sexual selection.
Right.
Now, several things. We're not talking about whether women might prefer better musicians.
Mm-hmm.
What
okay.
they're trying to get at, or whether men might prefer better musicians, although there are some studies that maybe show that musical ability might correspond to various things like higher testosterone levels and it's all very squidgy in there, but this is not about that. This is not about whether women prefer better musicians. It's about whether women prefer certain kind of music.
Uh-huh. Greater complexity.
Greater complexity. So the idea that perhaps men might have made music, not played music, but made music, composed music, made up music in order to impress women.
Right.
And the hypothesis being that if that were true, then, like other sexually selected traits that women prefer around ovulation, like masculinity of face, which is one. Intelligence is under question. There's conflicting conflicting results on whether women prefer more intelligent men around the time when the women are fertile or not.
Right.
But there are some easy, definite ones, like they prefer more masculine faces.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, let's jump to the chase. What did they find?
Well, nothing, actually, for several reasons. It was kind of. Let me tell you what they did.
Okay.
They played 6 different pieces of artificially created music.
Mm-hmm.
For women in various parts of their cycle, and they made it by computer program. So right away, it's a little bit. It was structured in a way that made it sound like music. They used a standard chord change, and they created 6 pieces of music that had increasing amounts of complexity. In I know you're going to ask, what do you mean complexity? How did they increase complexity with a computer program? But the least complex was basically just long notes that fit with the chords.
Okay.
And then they increased various variables, like the rhythmic complexity of a tune, the intervals, size at which the melody would jump, the syncopation of notes, whether the notes changed on the beat and with the chord or not. And then one other factor, rhythmic complexity, just sheer rhythm of the notes.
Okay.
And it doesn't really matter what they did, because they very nicely surveyed one set of women and asked them how complex they thought the music was. And they sort of got, for these 6 samples, a rating of complexity. And they found, indeed, that the women's rating of how complex the musical samples were corresponded neatly with how complex the scientists thought the music and the programming thought it was. And then they very carefully used a different set of women to do the preference testing. They tested them for their hormone levels using the same sorts of tests that you test when you're trying to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw how fertile they were, and they asked them to rate their liking for each of these 6 morsels of music.
Mm-hmm.
Morsels, excerpts, pieces, morsels of music. And when I say they got a negative result, basically they found that the women, everyone all the time, liked the more complex pieces more.
Regardless. Uh-huh.
And they kind of rated their liking. Nobody liked the 2 simplest pieces, which I tried to listen to these excerpts, and I wasn't able to
mm-hmm.
listen to them on the website. But their descriptions of them sounded extremely boring.
Right.
Plus, they were synthesized, so they probably just didn't sound really good.
Right.
And all the women liked the more complex pieces more. But unfortunately, it kind of fell into like 2 categories. Either they liked it or they didn't. And basically, they didn't like the 2 simplest, and they did like
the more complex.
Yeah, and in an average, it kind of averaged out over the women. They didn't really prefer the more complex of the complex anymore than the
right.
At a certain level of complexity, they liked it, and below a certain level of complexity, they didn't like it.
Right. So if I may, I mean, because I read the introduction, and the researchers. You know, their hypothesis was that ovulating women would prefer more complex music. And they say we did not find evidence for this hypothesis, right?
Right.
So, but you're sort of going beyond that and saying that you're questioning whether the study had any validity at all.
Right.
Whether or not it's evidence either way.
Yeah.
That maybe it's just the setup that they did in the end, it was just like, well, clearly the less boring music is more interesting.
Exactly. They didn't have enough of a variety of complexity.
Uh-huh.
Or else our brains don't have enough of a perception of complexity. Like, once the music reached a certain level of complexity, we were like, okay, we like that. It sounds like music.
Right.
Below that, we didn't like it.
Right.
So there's no way really of knowing. There was no difference between women at ovulation or not. But then again, there wasn't enough variation in the complexity of the music mm-hmm. for that to really be an indication of anything.
Yeah, I see.
Is basically what I'm saying. And also, we don't really know. Well, I will say there seem to be some background studies that they're building on that show that people in general like more complex music.
People in general.
Yeah.
like in, more in, complex
when,
music.
When you do studies similar to this using artificial music that you've made up just with levels of complexity on rhythmic and melodic, people prefer music when it's more quote-unquote complex.
Right.
So, but there are other levels of complexity that they didn't play with, like harmony. They did not change the harmony. Orchestration, color. They didn't play with the instruments. So it was all the same sound. And so perhaps they could redo it and have more variables and get women to have more of a preference for more complex music.
But yeah, it sounds like it's, it's not really evidence in any particular direction.
It's not evidence in any particular direction.
So we still don't know why music evolved.
Yeah, and they also point out that this has nothing to do with who is performing the music and how well they're doing it. So they try, especially to leave open the idea that maybe our preference for complexity evolved alongside our preference for mates who could perform complex music. So once it gets to a certain level of complexity, we're impressed when somebody can perform it.
Right.
So they didn't, obviously, they weren't testing that. They weren't using musicians at all. They weren't using flesh and blood musicians. So they really tried to leave that open as maybe their next line of research.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what we clever humans come up with to test the different theories.
About our own evolution.
About our own evolution. No, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. I hope I live to see a more definitive answer, because right now when I read about this, it's just a lot of people yelling at each other.
Yeah, it is. And there are so many conflicting theories and so little evidence for any of them.
Well, thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Wait, are we done?
Are we ending on a wah-wah?
Oh, I guess we are ending on a wah-wah. But that's okay, because sometimes life ends in wah-wah.
Yeah, and you know, this leaves open a great mystery for all you mystery mongers out there.
What do women want?
We know. The men,
Mel
too.
Gibson, right? I'm sorry.
I also don't like the idea that they only tested women's preference of men, although of course there is a phenomenon of
men don't ovulate,
fangirls, and like women tend to be fans much more than men. And oh my god, I'm getting so off the topic. Would you bring in the final music and shut me up, please? Thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir
from scopesmonkeychoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us.
Look it up yourselves.
Nevertheless, each episode has scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations. We love feedback, and you can write to scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com.
You can leave us a review on iTunes, especially if it's good.
And you can call the monkey phone and leave a message, 347-788-0330. And that's it. So I don't know what's happening next week. World Science Festival.
Oh, yeah, World Science Festival. We're going to be doing a little reporting from the World Science Festival, probably.
Yeah, here in New York City, starting Wednesday, going throughout the whole weekend. Check it out. There's all sorts of awesome events, and there's free stuff and paid stuff. And yes, World Science Festival. Hi, Maki. Bye.
Bye.